three books. If you can only buy one book on the Puritans, The Genius of Puritanism by Peter Lewis will enlighten and delight you. It's inexpensive. It's a paperback. If you're serious, this book, you can read it or you can use it as a doorstop. It's Reformation Heritage Books. Joel Beakey has produced some of the greatest Reformed literature in the 21st century. And I'm going to talk more about that tomorrow. But you can't buy them tomorrow. So I thought I'd give a recommendation. Meet the Puritans with a Guide to Modern Reprints. Now, this looks like an encyclopedia, a formidable book. But actually, it's nice little concise, wonderfully written biographies of the greatest of the Puritan ministers and the men of the Westminster Assembly. So I recommend the book if you want to read about the Puritans. You don't have to sit down and read through this whole book. You can just pick and choose and read about some of the Puritans. It will enlighten and encourage you when you see these men from a time of great pressure and difficulty who responded in a godly fashion and preach the gospel. And if you want something on the Scots Presbyterians, particularly the men of the Westminster Assembly, this little Makers of Puritan History is a nice little book by Lone. It has Henderson and Rutherford, the same pictures that they have up on the stand there of them, as well as John Bunyan and let's see, who's the fourth? Can't see. Oh, Baxter. Richard Baxter. So that is a wonderful, a well-written book with four biographies contained in them. Kind of. And if you're interested in the Scots Covenanters, the two most famous books happen to be on sale here. One's called A Cloud of Witnesses, published by Sprinkle Publication. And the other, by Banner of Truth, The Scots Worthies by John Howie. These are biographies of the Scots Worthies, the Cloud of Witnesses that I started out with in this conference and that I'm going to talk about right now. So those are some books that are for sale back there, and they're worth your attention if you still read books that are contained within covers rather than on a pixel machine. I want to talk to you about three different covenanters. In order to do that, I'm going to have to scoot right along and keep in mind the time. In August of 1633, King Charles I, here we go again, old Charlie, appointed William Laud to be the Archbishop of Canterbury. And the first thing that he did is he created the bishopric of Edinburgh in Scotland. Scotland was Presbyterian. The members of Parliament were all members of the Kirk. Presbyterian Church of Scotland was called the Kirk. It still is. By the way, it is still the National Church of Scotland. Church of Scotland today is Presbyterian. I mean, it's as liberal as any church could possibly conceivably be. But it still, nonetheless, still has a few evangelical preachers within their ranks. But the Kirk of Scotland was the Church of Scotland. And the first thing that Charles did was appoint William Laud, who then appointed a bishop for Edinburgh in 1633. In 1636, they created the Book of Canons. Those aren't canons that have gunpowder in them. It's the Book of Rules. And then in 1637, the service book was published. These were all Anglican high church liturgies that were to be used by the Church of Scotland as the Church of Scotland was slowly being dismantled to become Episcopalian again. Now, you might wonder, the Anglican Church is Protestant. What's the big problem with these Scots? It's not like their paganism is being imposed on them. It's not like popery is being brought back to them, although they saw it that way to some extent. What's the big problem? The big problem is this. that the Scots Presbyterians believed, and I mentioned it earlier, that to worship God, you can only do what he has commanded. And the Anglican Church was adding all sorts of other things to the worship of God. And they believed that that was wrong, that it was sinful to do that. They had gotten rid of all the popish superstitions, not to have them brought back by the bishops of the Anglican Church. So while they had doctrines in common, and you could ask the Anglicans, and many of them would say, or most of them would say, salvation is by faith alone. So they had this doctrine in common. What they didn't have in common was how ought God to be worshipped. And to the Scots, that was really plain and clear in the scripture, and they weren't going to budge off of it. Now today, most Christians don't understand that because they're willing to compromise and bring in all kinds of innovations over the years that have become commonplace in the evangelical church of whatever stripe it is, and in the Reformed church as well. And so this doesn't resonate with us in the same way that it did with the Scots Presbyterians, who had been under papist tyranny for centuries and had finally overthrown it and brought biblical religion to Scotland. And now the Church of England was trying to impose on these Presbyterian Scots a whole new thing. The bishops disbanded the General Assemblies, said that the Presbyteries couldn't meet anymore. And what happened, of course, in 1638 was that the Scots composed especially under Henderson and several others, they composed what became known as the National Covenant. This was a covenant that they were going to sign on to in masses. I'm going to tell you about that in a second. But this rebellion against the bishops, the rebellion against Anglicanism, began with a very interesting incident in St. Giles Kirk. The bishop had come into Edinburgh. He was in John Knox's old church, and he was getting ready to introduce the new Anglican liturgies to the greatest Presbyterian church in the English-speaking world. And he got ready to, wearing his vestments and with the altars and the candles and all the things that came with High Church Anglicanism, there was a little old woman who brought her stool, and she was sitting on it out in the church. Her name was Jenny Geddes, and I'll read to you. It's called a creepy stool. It's a folding stool, and she's sitting on it, and the dean is getting ready to announce the new liturgy, and she stands up, she takes the stool, and she wings it at his head. And she says, "Dail gie you colic, the way ma ye false thief, dar ye say mass in me lug." What she said in broad Scots, "Devil cause you colic in your stomach, false thief, dare you say the mass in my ear, in my lug." And with that, a general tumult erupted in the congregation, shouting abuse, throwing Bibles, stools, sticks, and stones. Preble reports the phrase, "Dar you say mass in my lug," is being addressed to a gentleman of the congregation, but it was addressed directly to the dean. And the riot caused the Anglican ministers to flee to the back of the church and out the back door, and the congregation rioted. It flowed out into the streets. They were not going to have Anglicanism in Edinburgh anytime soon, now that Jenny Geddes had thrown the stool at the bishop. And from that then came, in 1638, the composition of the Scottish covenant, from which the Covenanters gained their name. And here is, I want to read some of it to you. This is a national covenant that was drawn up for all people of Scotland, for the whole population of Scotland, to swear an oath to keep. It's a covenant. It's a national covenant that everybody that wanted to could sign onto it. And that included the Parliament. All the members of Parliament lined up and signed it. They put it in Greyfriars Kirkyard, where they had the National Covenant laid out, and 60,000 people in Edinburgh came by and signed it. And then it traveled around Scotland, and people signed it. Thousands and thousands of people signed their name to this National Covenant, and this is what they swore to do. This is what it says, in part. The Confession of Faith of the Kirk of Scotland, subscribed at first by the King's Majesty and his household in the year of God 1580. They had done this back in 1580. This was a reassertion of it and a restating of it. Therefore, by persons of all ranks in the year 1581, by ordinance of the Lords of the Secret Council, Acts of the General Assembly, subscribed again by all sorts of persons in the year 1590, and now in the year 1638, by us noblemen, barons, gentlemen, burgesses, ministers, and commons, under subscribing, as anybody could sign it. And people from every walk of life and every social strata signed this national covenant. We all, and every one of us underwritten, do protest that after long and due examination of our own consciences in matters of true and false religion, we are now thoroughly resolved, think of your Congress signing this, and due examination of our own consciences in matters of true and false religion, we are now thoroughly resolved of the truth by the word and spirit of God, and therefore we believe with our hearts, confess with our mouths, subscribe with our hands, and constantly affirm before God and the whole world that this only is the true Christian faith and religion, pleasing God and bringing salvation to man, which now is by the mercy of God revealed to the world by the preaching of the blessed evangel and received, believed, and defended by many and sundry notable kirks and realms, but chiefly by the Kirk of Scotland, the King's Majesty, and three estates of this realm as God's eternal truth and only ground of our salvation. As more particularly is expressed in the confession of our faith, it goes on and on about Christian liberty, about the sufficiency of the scripture, about the importance of preaching the gospel to all men, about salvation by faith in Christ alone. It goes on against the Catholic priesthood and affirms the priesthood of the believer. It condemns the doctrines of the Romish Church and of the Anglican Church, purgatory, for instance, the belief in purgatory, of baptizing bells, crossing yourself, all the things that the Anglican Church did and that were remnants of the Catholic Church are condemned in this document. And then they go on to state what they do believe. And they cite all the acts of Parliament that have been passed to affirm godly lawgiving and godly behavior for those who rule over them, as well as for the people themselves. Like as many acts of parliaments are conceived for maintenance of God's true and Christian religion. The purpose of Parliament is to maintain God's true religion, the Christian faith, as it is spelled out here in its all its reformed majesty. I would recommend that sometime you read the National Covenant and think, oh, I wonder if my congressman would sign that. Some people were so intent on the signing of the covenant and the importance of it that they cut themselves and they signed it with their own blood. And if you look at the original National Covenant, which you can, you'll see that a number of the signatures were signed in blood. That's how serious these Scots took covenanting before God to live godly lives themselves and to create a godly Christian kingdom. Their parliament, all the members of parliament signed it. And it is interesting that King James I, when he was James VI of Scotland, signed it. You know, back in 1590, it was signed by the king. It's going to be signed again by Charles II. But he's going to turn on them. As soon as he's crowned King of England, he's going to tear it up and say, ha, I was just kidding, I'm a Catholic. But these people that signed it, the Covenanters, were dead serious about it. I want to tell the stories of three different Covenanters. We can get through all three stories. And the first one is near and dear to my heart for a couple of reasons. He was the pastor of the Church of the Holy Rood, that is the Holy Cross, in Stirling. It's Stirling Church and Stirling Castle have cropped up earlier. And leading up to what happened with this very first martyr of the Covenanters was that after the signing of the National Covenant and the Scots putting down their foot, Charles I ended up going to war with the Scots, and they defeated him, and they defeated him twice. And that's why he called the Long Parliament, because he wanted money to fight a third war with the Scots. And Parliament, of course, we know what happened. And out of that came the Westminster Confession of Faith, which was adopted by the Scottish Kirk as their confession of faith. So the Westminster Confession and Catechisms and several other documents along with it became part and parcel of the Kirk of Scotland. And it became the constitution of the Presbyterian Church, and every single Presbyterian Church that was transplanted to America in the coming centuries held to the exact same doctrinal constitution. So, the Westminster Confession is in place in Scotland. The Kirk has declared it. The people have signed the National Covenant that they are a Christian nation. They will not waver from their commitment. And the king has gone to war with them. They've defeated him twice. And then they align themselves with Parliament in that covenant they signed with Parliament, the Solemn League and Covenant, where England promises to do the same thing that Scotland did. Now, we know that in the end, that's not what happens. Nonetheless, the Westminster Confession takes place. Oliver Cromwell becomes the Lord Protector. He has to come to Scotland and fight the Scots. And then he grants religious freedom, and the Kirk is free for the first time in history. And it's a wonderful period. However, many of the Scots preachers, including our first Covenanter, didn't like Oliver Cromwell. They believed he was a usurper, that Charles II should be the king of England and Scotland because he was the inheritor of the crown. And there's lots of contention between the Presbyterians in Scotland and the Puritans in England and with Oliver Cromwell. In fact, one of this first man I want to tell you about, the Reverend James Guthrie, actually preached a sermon in Stirling in his church with Oliver Cromwell sitting right there in the front row listening to him. And he preached against the usurpation of the kingship, of the legitimate ordained kingship. But Oliver Cromwell liked his preaching, and so he sat through it. And he liked his exposition of the Word of God. This man's name was James Guthrie, and I want to tell you a little bit about him. The reason that I love James Guthrie, there are lots of reasons why I do, but I am descended from him 13 generations. And so he's my grandfather 13 generations back. So he's the pastor at Stirling, and he is one of the most famous preachers in Scotland at the time. He lived from 1612 to 1661. He was from if you've been to Scotland, he was from Angus, which is a county north of the Firth. In fact, up near St. Andrews, not too far from there, actually. And he had studied under the great Samuel Rutherford. In fact, James Guthrie and Samuel Rutherford had a very close relationship, and they corresponded throughout their lives until Guthrie died. And Rutherford died shortly after James Guthrie did, but they were friends, and they held to the same views. One Scottish historian has likened James Guthrie to Mr. Standfast in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. He left St. Andrews and became the pastor of a humble little Presbyterian church in Louder. He had chosen not the path which led to a bishop's mitre, but to the crown of cactus thorns, as Smellie has said in his book, The Men of the Covenant. He was a man of fervent zeal and calm temper. He was a little short man like myself. He was called by Cromwell the little man who couldn't bow, knowing that he wouldn't bow to the bishops and he wouldn't bow to Oliver Cromwell either. And if you actually go to his church today in Stirling, they have a little kiosk set up where you can see his picture, and there's a little interpretation of him because he's the most famous preacher that's ever been at Stirling. And they have to admit that he was there because that's why people come there to visit, is to see the place of James Guthrie. And what, how does the pastor of the church, he smiles very nicely when you come in. I'm glad you're here. Oh, you want to hear about James Guthrie? Now you got to go over there, read that thing. And he's disappointed, you know. But it says, you said the little kiosk says James Guthrie was a wild and bigoted Presbyterian minister who pastored this church from such and such to such and such. He wrote a very famous book that dealt with the whole subject of Lex Rex, that is, the tyranny of the king, and it was considered subversive. It was burned along with Rutherford's books, and it's that book that he wrote that got him eventually arrested. What happened in 1660 is that Charles II, Richard Cromwell was the Lord Protector in England, and he was poor, and a lot of people wanted a king back. And so Charles told the Scottish Parliament if they would crown him king, he would come back, and Parliament then would invite him, and he came back to England. And the crown was placed on his head by the Duke of Argyll, the greatest Presbyterian in nobleman in Scotland. And the reason that he crowned and why the Scots were thrilled to have a legitimate king back on the throne from their perspective was that he signed the National Covenant. And he guaranteed the Scots that they could worship God as conscience dictated and as their national covenant so forthrightly stated. As soon as he became the King of England, he brought bishops in and put them in all the bishoprics. He expelled 2,000 Puritan ministers from their pulpits in England. And he sent bishops to Scotland to destroy the Presbyterian Church in Scotland. And men like James Guthrie were not going to stand for it. He continued to preach against the royal tyranny. And the king, thinking he would be clever, offered all kinds of incentives to go along with his program. You know, we'll give you an Obama phone if you will just read this particular liturgy in church. There were all kinds of incentives. And many ministers went along with that. So I can keep my pulpit. I won't be expelled like those Puritans. The Kirk will remain the same. All I have to do is compromise a little bit on this thing here. All I have to do is use the prayer book. And these prayers are okay. Why not? I would use them. And so a lot of ministers did that. James Guthrie refused to do it. So the city fathers came to him and they said, please, just take this little book and use the service that's in this book. It'll keep the bishops happy. We get to keep our Kirk, do what we want to do. Just do this. It reminds you of Daniel, doesn't it? You just pray to the king and, you know, admit or burn a little incense to Caesar. That isn't hard. Burn this incense to Caesar as the Lord. Christians have been faced with these things down through the centuries. And James Guthrie saw it as the same sort of thing. City fathers demanded that he do this. He said, no, I won't do it. But his assistant pastor said, I will. And there were people in the congregation that agreed with the assistant pastor. So at Stirling, they built a wall down the middle of the church, floor to ceiling. And that wall stayed there until 1923. And James Guthrie preached on one side of the wall to those who would not be abjured, those who would not join the bishop's ranks. And his assistant pastor preached, don't feel like you're being compromised on this side, preached to the other congregation that said, this isn't bad, it's just a little liturgical thing. And Eventually, though, Charles decided to make examples of what he considered the two worst covenanters, as they were called, men who signed the covenant and would stand by it till their death. And he chose the Duke of Argyll, the man who placed a crown on his head, and James Guthrie, the pastor of the church in Stirling. And he was arrested. Both of them were arrested, and they were locked in the dungeon in Edinburgh and tried for treason before the Privy Council. And the Privy Council had already gotten their marching orders from England that you are to find this man guilty of treason and have him executed. And so James Guthrie defended himself before the Privy Council. And some of the men in the Privy Council, his speech and his biblical defense of his beliefs was so eloquent that several members of the council got up and left. They would not follow through with condemning him to death. But the other members of the council went along with the program, and he was declared an outlaw of the realm, a man who had committed treason by questioning the state. And this extreme and bigoted Presbyterian then was sentenced to be executed in the grass market in Edinburgh, along with the Marquis of Argyll. While he was locked in the dungeon awaiting his death, Guthrie was visited by a number of his friends and his own family. He had a little tiny daughter and a son, and he took the son on his lap and told him, "Your daddy's going away. He's not coming back. You need to be a man who stands for the Lord Jesus and take care of your mother." Part of the declaration against him as a traitor to the realm was that nobody could offer any kind of succor to his family. They were to be outcasts. They were not allowed to ever own their own home. And I'm here to assert that it's still true for some reason. But they were to be cast out. No one was to offer them food or shelter or do anything that would enable them to survive. And of course, the people of Edinburgh, and they were faithful people everywhere who took care of his family. Eventually, that son would grow up to become a pastor, and he would have a couple children of his own. And one of his sons, emigrated to Northern Ireland, to Ulster. And from there, he came to Connecticut, and from there to Western New York, and et cetera, until he became one of my forebears. But he was condemned to death. He was taken to the grass market. He was put up on they built the scaffold. All of Edinburgh turns out for it. And in those days, men who were condemned to their death like that were allowed to say any last words that they had. And so he preached a sermon, and they said that it was like he was standing in his pulpit. It was very eloquent. He was totally calm, and he was absolutely reconciled to meeting the Lord. In fact, the executioner said, you need to repent of your sins against the king. And he said, "If I did that, it wouldn't be good, because I'm going to see the King of Kings, and I need to be faithful to him." And he preached a sermon to the crowd. And typically what they would do is as they brought them down from the jail, the drummers would lead them down. And when they got up on the scaffold, if they started to say something against the king, the drummers would beat the drums so the people couldn't hear what they were saying. But he didn't say anything against the king. He preached the gospel to the crowd, and he preached about standing firm in their faith, no matter what comes, etc. He was hanged. James Guthrie was hanged. His head was cut off and stuck on the Netherbow port below the castle, and it became a capital offense to move it. Stayed there for 20-some years. And in fact, even they said that his children saw their father's head hanging on the castle wall and asked about him time to time. And the tartan of the Guthrie family, not the tartan, but the badge of the Guthrie family is Slo Pro Veritate. Sto Pro Veritate. I stand for truth. That's the motto of the Guthrie clan. I stand for truth. And nobody stood for truth more than James Guthrie did, the first of the Covenanter martyrs. Well, he was only the first. There are going to be thousands and thousands of men, women, and children who are going to be put to death by the soldiers under the orders of the British government. Oftentimes it was Scottish soldiers in English pay. Sometimes it was Highlanders. They would bring the Highlanders down and they would put them, they would garrison them in the homes of known Covenanters without any restraints, without any laws. That's one of the reasons the British had followed that in the following century. And it's one of the things that got into the U.S. Constitution. They can't quarter soldiers in your home. It started with bringing some of the wild tri-Catholic tribesmen down into the lowlands and putting them in Covenanter homes. The second man, I need to hurry along, was a man named Richard Cameron. He's the subject of this drawing up here. And Richard Cameron was a man who became a preacher during the times of persecution in the 1660s and 1670s and 1680s. It was about 28 years of persecution in which more and more indulgences were offered to pastors who would compromise. They could have their churches back. But the men who wouldn't were called Covenanters, and they would go out and they would preach in the fields. And they made it illegal to preach in the fields. And Richard Cameron, eventually, as the years went by, Richard Cameron finally was the last preacher who would go out and preach in the fields. And the soldiers were sent out from Edinburgh in every direction to try and catch congregations that were preaching illegally in the remote areas of Scotland. And it's an amazing phenomenon. And as a matter of fact, the more the persecution extended, the larger the congregations got. It was an amazing phenomenon. And they were called conventicles. Conventicle was an illegal worship service. It was held in forests, fields, caves, barns, anywhere but the churches from which the pastors had all been expelled and been replaced, if they were replaced at all, replaced by men who used the Anglican prayer books and the Anglican liturgies and all the things being forced on them by the king. And part and parcel of that, I mean, really at the bottom of it was this. The king is the head of the church. And if you didn't admit that the king of England was the head of the Christian church, then you were a heretic and you deserved to die because you were a rebel and a traitor. And the Covenanters, at the heart of the Covenanters' doctrine, was that Christ is the head of the church. That the Kirk belongs to God, not to the king of England. And so these Presbyterian Covenanters would never admit to the king being the head of the church, ever. One after one, they said, okay, that's a small thing. The king's the head of the church. The Covenanters said, no, Jesus Christ is the head of the church. And it's only to him we give our allegiance. It's in him that we have our hope. It's in him that we have our salvation. And he's the one who's told us how to worship him. And we're not going to change from that. And they were killed by the hundreds. Not all the Scots Covenanters sat by and allowed themselves to be killed. They began carrying weapons to their services, the conventicles out in the forests and fields because their families were being threatened and sometimes killed. So they determined they were going to defend their families from the attacks of the soldiers when they could find them. And at one point, an army was even raised and a battle was fought against the king's troops. A big pitched battle like in a war, in a place called Pentland Hills. These Covenanters were just farmers. They were just farmers and merchants. And the soldiers came, the professional soldiers came, and just destroyed the Covenanter army at the Pentlands. And they rounded up hundreds of them, including a number of preachers. And many were put on trial. Dozens of them were hanged, drawn and quartered. And others were sent to the most deadly prison of all. It's called the Bass Rock. The Bass is a little island out in the North Sea, and there's a castle on it. And that's where they would be transported to the Bass Rock, where many of them died of hardship out there. So if you got sent to the Bass, you knew you were, if you survived it, that was really saying something about God's preserving a person. While Richard preached to high and to low, hundreds and hundreds of people were converted through his evangelistic preaching. God used him mightily to reach the hearts of people. And he also carried on as a faithful pastor to the conventicles as they met throughout the 1670s and 80s. And he was condemned roundly by the church. It's interesting. The more orthodox you are and the more you take a stand for the truth, the more you're attacked by members of the church. And that's really was true of the Covenanters. Many of their fellow ministers condemned them for not compromising and going along with the king and what the king wanted. You were a traitor if you didn't. And that's how they're interpreted today, by the way. That's how historians interpret the Covenanters, a bunch of traitors, because they wouldn't recognize the King of England as the head of the church. Simple thing. Now, it's the same with the early Christians and Caesar. Well, Richard, I'd love to tell you the whole story of Richard Cameron. We don't have time for that. But Richard Cameron and his family, his brothers joined him. His father was thrown in prison in Edinburgh because he supported them. And he preached to a couple audiences of 14,000 people. I mean, everybody came to hear Richard Cameron preach in the fields. And the army didn't want to show up at that one, that's for sure. But if you look on this drawing up here, you see up on the skyline a bunch of men on horses, and they're obviously carrying guns and swords. They became known as the Cameronians. They were from the Cameron clan, and they would go to a place where they could see a long distance. So if the king's troops came riding towards them, if they'd been revealed by a spy, and the king had spies everywhere, and there were real traitors everywhere trying to turn in their neighbors and get the Covenanters thrown in prison or fined or killed. And so they began protecting themselves with pickets. And just as an aside, during the next century, the Scottish regiments in the British Army became the British Army. The entire British Empire was created and protected by Scottish regiments. And one of those regiments were the Cameronians. And they were the descendants of the ones who protected the Lion of the Covenant, as Richard Cameron was called, the Lion of the Covenant. And these men that protected the congregation during that time, Cameronians, became the Cameronian Regiment in the British Army. And when they were issued their kit, not just their kilt or their trews and their uniform, they were issued a Bible. And they were godly men, and they had a godly reputation. The same with the Sutherlands, which was another Scottish Highland regiment that was Presbyterian. And they had these reputations of being godly men. And they could be sent anywhere in the empire. They would fight and die for the king in succeeding centuries. But they remained true to their covenantal heritage, especially of Richard Cameron. Well, Cameron finally was tracked down by a bunch of troops. Other battles were fought. The Battle of Bothwell Bridge is the biggest battle between Covenanters and the king's troop, and it was a big battle. And the big problem, of course, was that the Covenanters weren't soldiers, per se, but they fought a large and sort of successful battle at Bothwell Bridge at first. But as they had these various losses, each one set them back even further. And then the king would offer amnesty. All you had to do was fill in the blank. And there were always some who would take the king's offer. And then in 1680 came the Sanquhar Declaration, in which Richard Cameron wrote up a treatise declaring that he no longer held any allegiance to the king at all, any kind of allegiance to the king. And it was posted in the town of Sanquhar. And that was taken as a declaration of war against England. Actually, all it was really about was the spiritual warfare that they were fighting. That's what he was talking about. And the king knew it. But the king of England wanted to absolutely destroy these bandits. Well, in the end, he was caught out with a number of his brother and a number of his close friends. A troop of cavalry came on them, and they fought a pitched battle, and they killed a whole lot more of the soldiers than they killed of the Covenanters. But Richard Cameron was killed, and the younger men got away. Cameron himself said, "Got to save the young, let them take the old." And so he died in battle against a troop of the king's horse. And they cut off his head and his hands, and they took it to the prison in Edinburgh and showed it to his father. And they said, "What do you think of that?" And he said, "Thank the Lord for a godly son." And so ended Richard Cameron. And then for a while there weren't any preachers. And then the last preacher came, and he turns out to become the last martyr of the Covenanters, with hundreds in between, a man by the name of James Renick. And I'll say a few words about him. I do want to interject one other story that some of you I already know are familiar with, but just to show you the length that they went to get people to recant their confession of Christ. It applied to women and children too. And some of you have heard the story of the two Margarets, Margaret Wilson and I can't remember the other Margaret. And one was an elderly lady and one was a young woman, 18 years old or 17 years old. And they were Covenanters. And they refused to swear their allegiance to the king as the head of the church. So they were taken and they were tied to stakes out in the edge of the North Sea when the tide would come in. Actually, it was a river. It was a tidal river, and the tide would come in. And the older woman was tied to a stake further out. And as the tide came in and the waters rose, they yelled from the shore for her to recant. And she refused, and she was drowned. And as the tide came in closer, then the young Margaret, as the waters rose, they yelled, "You have your whole life ahead of you. All you need to do is just say that the king is the head of the church and we'll turn you loose and you can live a long and wonderful life." And she said, "I'll never deny my Lord. I'll never admit that anyone other than the Lord Christ is the head of the church." And she drowned too. And so they came up with these creative ways of forcing people to recant. And some people did. The two Margarets did not. And they became martyrs in the Presbyterian Church of the Covenanters. Again, this is a much more complicated and interesting and huge thing. And I can only tell you a few stories. And I encourage you to read the Scots Worthies in the Cloud of Witnesses, where the lives of these people are spelled out in detail. And it will be a great encouragement to you, but also give you maybe some insight into what maybe our children and grandchildren are going to face. And we face to some extent today, but nothing like the Covenanters did. And what may be down the road for us, we never know, given the fact the Apostle Paul has promised that these things would happen in the church from time to time. James Renick, called the preacher to the remnant, was a young man who was called to, he was born in 1662. He was born during the persecutions. And by the 1680s, he was convinced that he was called to gospel ministry. And he went to Holland, and there he received his theological training for a short while. Actually, before that, he graduated from the University of Edinburgh and also got a master's. And he was a brilliant young man and a fervent preacher. He went to Holland, and there he was actually ordained to be a pastor, because all of the engines of ordination in the Scottish Kirk were in the hands of the bishops, and they would not ordain a covenanter. They would not ordain anybody who didn't go along with their program. And so in order to be ordained, James Rennick went to Holland. And by the way, the Dutch provided a safe haven for thousands and thousands of believers all over Europe, all over England and Scotland and Germany and France. They came to Holland because there was religious freedom. It was a reformed country. And they were kind of loose around the edges as to who they would protect. They would protect anybody who was fleeing religious persecution. And the Scots came there, and they learned from the Dutch, and they were welcomed by them. And a lot of times people just stayed there and became Dutch themselves and got involved in business, which is what the Dutch were all about, was business. But they were Christian men and serious reformed thinkers, and they trained these men and offered safe havens before they would return to their home country. And that's what happened to James Rennick. But then when he returned, he began preaching in the conventicles again. And now he's the only preacher in the fields. And his conventicles are attended by 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 people. And the troops can't find them. They go out into those lonely moors in the highlands and in places in the lowlands where nobody ever went, and the people would stream there. They would leave home days ahead of time to be there to have a worship service and to hear James Rennick preach. And he was a powerful, powerful preacher. Well, Rennick did that for a number of years, having to flee time and again. He sneaked into Edinburgh a few times to visit with friends and family. And the last time he did that, he got caught. They were watching the house of a Covenanter merchant, and someone saw him go in. They didn't know it was him, but they went in, and he was caught. He was put on trial for high treason, for being a Presbyterian of the John Knox theology, a preacher of the covenant. Those were the accusations against him. And they asked him if the king was sovereign. And he said, well, the king is not sovereign in the Church of Christ. So I have allegiance to the king. He is my political sovereign, but he is not my sovereign Lord in the church. Only Christ is. Okay, well, that's treason. He called the king a usurper, too, and denied his authority in the church. They asked him if he believed in the... This is interesting. They asked him if he believed in the right to keep and bear arms for self-defense. And he said, yes. And they said, treason. Treason. That will get you executed, believing in using firearms to defend yourself and your family. That's interesting. And they also asked him if he denied the paying of the cess at CESS. And he said, yes, I deny that too. That was tax. It was tax that was used to support the bishops. And he told people not to pay it because it was used to support the bishops. I know people who don't pay their taxes because it's used to support abortion. It's the same principle in a way. But he denied these things. And of course he was, and the jury was Presbyterian, by the way. They were very careful to pick, Presbyterians to form the jury, men who had abjured the faith and had gone along with the new royal authority. And he was sentenced to be hanged in the Grass Market, in the same spot that James Guthrie had been back in 1661. Now it's 1688. And James Renick is going to be hanged in the same place. And while he's waiting in prison, members of the Privy Council come and ask him to renounce his testimony. Just say that the king is the head of the church. We'll let you go. They didn't want to hang him. He was such an eloquent young man, and they knew that he was a godly man, and they didn't want to execute him. They even sent two Catholic priests in to try and persuade him. And he saw these two priests come in, and he said, "Away with you, priests." And that became a saying in Scotland, when people would say, as Renick said, "Away with you, priests." It became famous. While he was there, he preached. He wrote letters, smuggled them out. He wrote some wonderful things. And in the end, he was taken down to the grass market to the sound of the drums. And they kept drumming the whole time when he was up there, because they knew he'd say stuff against the king. But he preached long and loud to those who could hear him, you know, right in the front rows and standing. He had friends that stood with him on the scaffold. And Renick was hanged. And he was 26 years old. He'd been preaching for 7 years in the conventicles in the fields. And he'd been joined by only one or two other men. But he was the last martyr of the Covenanters. For in 1688, that same year, James II, who had replaced Charles II, was overthrown by Parliament. And William and Mary came to the throne of England. And they granted religious freedom to the Kirk of Scotland, at least to some extent, for the time being. But James Renick was the last of the great martyrs of the covenant, a godly, godly man who was willing to sell his life for the sake of the gospel. Same as Richard Cameron, same as James Guthrie. They were all different men. They all had a little different role to play. And there were thousands of others. But those were three men who were willing to die for their faith. And I think that they are more than worthy of our study. And as Dr. Moorcraft says, the world was not worthy of such men.